Economic Development. I understand the Senate is in meeting right at this moment as we speak. What we're doing is we'll go ahead and open a public hearing on both Senate Bills 397 and 3759, House Bill 3759. And we have Verlina Crosby signed up on both of those, Betsy Earle signed up on both of those, and Tim Nez has signed up on both of those. So let's start in that order, if we may, with Verlina on Senate Bill 397 and House Bill 3759, work session on both of these two bills. Or I'm sorry, public hearing only.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Verlina Crosley, the Director for the Oregon Employment Department, and I believe that you will have testimony in front of you from the department regarding Senate Bill 397. This is a bill that was brought to you from the Governor's Office and the Employment Department. It has passed out of committee. It does have a fiscal impact, which is the reason why it's here. Let me tell you a little bit about what it does. Senate Bill 397 adjusts and lowers the tax rate in three of Oregon's schedules. If you remember from our budget hearings, we talked about having eight schedules and that the optimum schedule is Schedule 4, which means that we would be collecting the same amount of taxes as we would be paying in. We have been in for some time the lower parts of those schedules because we've been trying to drag down the size of the trust fund. What this bill does is adjust the schedules 3, 4, and 5. So when we move to those schedules, we would not move to the current schedules, which means we would still be recovering too much. And I have some charts that I'll show you regarding those. It moderates then the changes from one unemployment insurance tax rate schedule to another, and it reduces the amount of taxes that employers are paying to the unemployment insurance trust fund for those schedules. I think probably the easiest thing for you to do would be to look at the charts that are attached, the first one having the bars that look like this. So when I talked about Schedule 4, you can see that we're not in those schedules. What happens is it's a self-adjusting mechanism to collect the amounts needed to pay the benefits that we project that we're going to be paying. So in the 1980s and early 90s when we were having recessions, we were in the higher rates, and now for some time we have been in Schedule 3. Just this year we lowered the tax rates by about $90 million when we moved to Schedule 2. Now what we are trying to do is moderate when we move up to 4, which again would be the optimum, or towards 4, that we would not be taxing the employers as much as if we were in the existing statutes. You can kind of see in the next chart, by using the average tax rate, we've tried to show you what Senate Bill 397 does versus the existing law. And you can see that the lighter color is where we would go with Senate Bill 397, so it moderates that jump up. However, if we stay with the existing schedules, there is a huge jump when we go from Schedule 2 to 3 and then 3 to 4, et cetera, et cetera. The amounts of the tax rates without a tax rate change would move from Schedule 3 to Schedule 4, which impose a 22% jump to employers, and a lot of that would be borne by small employers because they are at the lowest tax rates, generally speaking. The next chart would show you, this one is a minimum tax rate, where without the tax rate, moving from Schedule 3 to Schedule 4 would impose a 50% jump on 40% of Oregon employers, which are those small employers. The next page I'll have, Frank Ritchie works in our unemployment insurance analysis section, and he can walk through some of the changes that will also occur to show what the balances, the reserve balances will, the impact on those with the tax changes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Frank Ritchie. I'm manager of unemployment insurance programs and analysis with the Employment Department. And really, this is a recap of the numbers that are in the graphs. You can see the comparison of what the current average tax rate, that is just averaging all the tax rates paid by the employers, As you might recall from our earlier meetings here, the unemployment insurance taxes vary amongst employers based on their experience with the unemployment insurance system. So this is just representing the overall average and what's changing from current law to the averages as they would be under Senate Bill 397. And the lower couple of charts represent the changes to the minimum rate that was in the chart that Verlina just covered. Up at the top is showing you sort of when we are in the various schedules. Up at the top where it says percent of 12 months of benefits, it's unfortunately, this is an approach to look at it that makes sense to actuaries and us, but for most of us normal people, we like to think how many months of unemployment benefits is there in there if we were in a recession, rather than what percent is it of 1 year. The goal that was set in public policy is to have 18 months worth of benefits in reserves, and you can see that that sort of bolded one in the middle that says 145 to 170% of 12 months, in English, that really, if we... Unfortunately, I put it down here copying the law, so if you look at the law, these are the numbers you see. But what that represents is that range around 18 months worth of unemployment benefits being available. 18 months is the sort of standard that the feds would like to see, and it's economically a sound number because what it does is get you through a recession and let you without having with enough reserves to cover it. If the more reserves you have, if you go down towards, for example, 200%, that really means 2 years. If you were down at the other end, you would have less than 1 year worth of reserves. And depending on which one you're in, you're in the various schedules. We right now think we're going to move towards Schedule 4 because of the payouts we're going to have over the next year, this winter and so on. While we expect to have a weaker economy, we're going to be drawing the reserves down. And we're going to be heading towards that 18 months level, which means we did a good job. We have much reserves in there to cover the payouts that are going to occur. We have plenty of reserves. We're going to really draw it down to where it should be. But when we do that, we don't want to impose a big tax jump on employers that would simply build the fund up back up to where it doesn't need to be.
So we have somewhere around 21 months currently in reserve, and if you remember what Frank said, that 18 is what the public policy that has been in statute for some time is really where we should be. So we've been calling this a reverse cliff effect that we're trying to mitigate, if you will, by trying to lower the tax schedules in that 3, 4, and 5. The last page that you have shows the impact on small, medium, and large employers. We tell you about percentages, but if you look at it in dollars, on the impact on a small employer at a minimum rate would be $50, and on a medium employer, $450, and a large employer would be $3,500. That would be just in Schedule 3 without the tax increases.
What is the definition of small, medium, large employers at that point?
Mr. Chair, down at the bottom of the chart, we just assumed some numbers there. And see, we said small employer at $50,000 level, medium at, yes, per year, sir. And the medium at $450,000, the large at $3.5 million. Just to give a picture around a given size.
In 1995, we looked at the health of the trust fund, and we had a similar bill that did pass, and it actually changed Schedules 1, 2, and 3. And now we're looking to make the same types of changes based on the health of the trust fund of need to change 3, 4, and 5, so it will help employers when we move to those schedules. I'd be open to any questions that the committee might have.
The questions for Ms. Crosley or Mr. Ritchie. I just want to make sure that I understand the effect on the small and what you're saying is that in the class four, and the class four is where the jumps are at here on the employer's for instance, a small employer at an average rate, class three, $50 an average, and class five is 45 reduction, whereas it's class four, it's 135, and that's what you're trying to iron out, is that can't grab anything there.
That is correct.
That's the reverse cliff.
That is correct.
Okay. Representative Ringo is recognized.
When was the last time these rates were changed?
1995.
And would you expect that if we have a significant economic downturn, there's going to be a need to change the rates again? Is that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ringo, we don't believe so. Generally, it has happened because of an extended long economy. These actual schedules were done in the, like, 80s when we were having large amounts of recessions. And so our actuaries are indicating that because we've had such an extended long period, that the size of the trust fund has been driving more interest than what was ever envisioned. And so that is the primary reason that has caused us to come back for rate adjustments. But the answer to your question is no, we do not project that. But it is based on projections.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me just ask one more question relative to what happens to an employer. This small employer who continues on with existing employees paying the $50,000 of employment wages as a result of the current changes, with the changing of the economy, do they automatically graduate from three into four without having an adverse change in their employment situation?
Mr. Chair, what happens is first we look at the health of the trust fund. We look at, based on the state economist's projections about how many people are going to be unemployed, et cetera. Then we, based on a statutory formula, we'll look at what schedule we're in. Once we indicate to employers which schedule we're going to be in, then they are based on their own experience. So it will be based on two factors. One, what actually happens with
the
schedule,
economy.
The whole economy,
right.
And then what individually happens
and that's the new rate that's published basically annually.
That's correct.
And so
when we send out in October, November,
right.
The notice to tax in paying employers, what's the schedule that we're going to be in,
okay.
Then within that schedule, the rate that they will pay will actually be based on their own experience.
So if they've got 10 years with no unemployment rate, their schedule could actually be changing and increasing just based upon the overall economy, and that's the second factor.
Mr. Chair, and the point of this is those people that have that minimum rate under current law would be going from A up here, and we're saying that they really, particularly the minimum rate employers ought to be not jumping so much just because of the overall economy.
And that's the, if I understand correctly, Frank, that's the 40% jump approximately.
Yes, sir.
As opposed to the proposal of 22% jump.
Sure, that's exactly right.
Okay. Other questions for relative to 397, Senate Bill 397, to Ms. Crosby and Mr. Ritchie. Now, did you want to go ahead? We're in a public hearing on both Senate Bill 397 and House Bill 3759, and I do have Representative Hansen here to testify on behalf of House Bill 3759. Can we do that, please, so that we can honor our colleague, Representative Hansen? Thank you for distinguishing our committee today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I had to journey all the way from room 170 to be here, so I've arduous journey, but I'll make my comments brief. I basically want to just thank you for holding the hearings on these two bills. 3759 is incredibly important to my district. As the economy has changed, we've been hit with layoffs that have affected over 2,000 workers just in House District 17. What this bill will do is create an opportunity for some of those workers to increase their skills. So on a personal standpoint, this this enables them to strengthen their families by maybe getting out of some of the less stable areas of employment, or increase their job skills so when the economy picks up, even if they go back to that same employer, they're going to be a stronger addition to the workforce. But by extending the benefits for an additional 26 weeks, if they're involved in retraining, it gives them a larger window of opportunity to take different types of classes. 26 weeks is a pretty short period if you're really going to go back and make a career change or do some major upgrading of skills. This gives the displaced worker a little bigger opportunity to be able to increase these. I think it strengthens our workforce overall in terms of attracting new employers or strengthening those employers that we already have. So it's real basic good bill. The linkage with 397 makes it a real win-win situation both for employees and for employers. And I think both, as we're kind of moving into the stormy seas of a little different kind of economy, these are two good ways to kind of batten the hatches down and prepare us in case the economy doesn't pick up as quickly as we'd like to see. Anyway, thank you very much for your attention to this bill and hopefully to be moving it forward. Good bill should pass. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Hanson. Are there questions of Representative Hanson? Representative Ringo is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming. I was just wondering if you could discuss the fiscal impact for a little bit. The sheet I'm looking at says that the unemployment insurance benefits impacted would be about $12.5 million. And that's a hit this biennium.
I believe it is.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that.
I just have one question that Representative Hanson relative to the economic downturns and the conditions which surrounded those downturns, the labor market increase in unemployment and lack of opportunity employment as a result of high energy costs. Is there some quantifiable method of determining that? Is that from one period to the next, and how do we quantify that?
I don't understand how it's quantified. I know that very, very clearly some of the layoffs in some of the employers in District 17 very definitely are energy related. Some of the chemical works. I don't know how it's broken down in terms of when it's very direct. Our energy rates have went up to the point that it makes our product, that we can't market our product in a profitable manner, and how it's affected on the indirect. But there are other people behind me that will be glad to answer that question when I get up.
Thank you very much. Representative Johnson's recognized.
Thank you. I guess I have another measurement bill, another measurement question in the same general area where you're looking. What the definition for a shift in production to another state is, and perhaps the department would be better qualified to answer that.
And then the secondary effects of foreign trade, those are pretty nebulous, but I think they're quantifiable somewhere. Someone has that information. So.
And they're right behind you.
All right. Thank you very much, you. Representative Hanson. We appreciate you coming today. We would like to go ahead and have then Ms. Crosby and Mr. Ritchie, as necessary, come forward, please.
Sorry, I'm late. Mr. Chair, again, for the record, I'm Berlina Crosley from the Employment Department. You probably do have a copy of my testimony since you've been talking about the high energy costs and shift production. We are actually having a more difficult time of trying to identify how many layoffs or the lack of employment opportunities due to the energy crunch, if you will, than we are with some other types of layoffs because it's not an industry. It is spread across industry. So you should know that we are working with the governor's office and even actually some individual legislators on trying to quantify that. If a company does not indicate in their layoff to their individual employees or to the department that it's associated with energy, we often do not know that. So it is difficult for us to identify. But there are some employers, and many employers actually, that are identifying that it is due to some kind of energy impact. And when we do know that, we are showing it. It is somewhat masked by the general economy, but we do know that there are layoffs being and lack of job opportunities being extended in those areas. The shift in production to another state or territory are under the NAFTA Trade Act declarations, and those are designations that are given when the layoff notices go out, and they do have it's another state.
Yeah, it's other states, so it wouldn't be.
Sorry. So, do you want to take that one? I was thinking it was the NAFTA Trade Act.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, actually, I think the attempt here is to be in areas where NAFTA and Trade Act isn't. And so this is to another state rather than another country, which is what NAFTA and Trade Act would deal with. And the main deal is we have, NAFTA Trade Act already goes beyond the timelines that are involved here. And so this would be covering the people that NAFTA are not being helped. So an example would be a plant moving to Texas or moving from here to somewhere outside the state and the workers being left behind needing to lacking employment opportunities.
So if I may start over again, Mr. Chair, I was looking at, in my testimony, you have the high energy costs, extended drought conditions and attendant economic conditions, secondary effects of foreign trade, and a shift of production to another state or territory of the United States. We crafted language working with labor on this and the Department of Labor because what we were trying to do is maximize the benefits that Oregon employers would be trying to put dollars for certain types of economic conditions in Oregon. And we have had to craft it just to be very clear to the Federal Department of Labor that we were not trying to use their money or our money first and then theirs money last. They looked disfavorably on that. But they have approved the language that you have in front of you that it allows the full use of federal dollars to be used like the federal government, Congress has indicated, but also allows the public policy in Oregon to allow individuals to have 26 additional weeks of unemployment insurance if they are lack of employment opportunities available. So it's not what we generally looked at as if the dislocations or layoffs are from those areas. It shifts it a little bit and says if there's a lack of employment opportunities due to these factors, then we also will look at whether or not funds should be able to be used for workers in retraining. Representative Johnson.
I want to make sure that I understand this because some of what you've said seem to suggest that an employer would have to identify the cause of the layoff in order to trigger the extended benefits. And I'm trying to get the level of equity or one employer would say this is drought related, another not, and that that would affect different classes of workers, and that's a concern to me. But I think I heard you say that it is the lack of job opportunity, not just the result of actual layoffs. Did I hear you correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, you did. We have a number of benefits to individuals based on types of layoffs. And in working with the Department of Labor and the Governor's Office and other members in this body, on page 2 of the bill, it actually talks about the supplemental benefits may be paid only to eligible dislocated workers whose unemployment, as determined by the director, is substantially due to the lack of employment opportunities in the workers' labor, local labor market resulting from those things that we're talking about. So it's not just that they were laid off. You have to look, one, if they're dislocated. So
So somebody is making a determination that they were dislocated worker. We know they've been laid off. They have no return date to the employer that they're working on, those kinds of things. And the definition of dislocated workers in other parts of the statute, in some regions, it's long-term employment, and the local area even identifies the long-term employment as just a few weeks of unemployment. So that would be one piece of it. Then I would also have to look at the agency to see whether or not there is opportunity, a lack of opportunity in these areas, and then those individuals would be eligible for unemployment insurance funds extension.
Representative Johnson.
This gives a great deal of discretion, it seems, to the director, and I'm looking for the sidebars that will guide the director in making these determinations. I'm looking for objectivity in the sidebars.
We had a similar program in the early 1990s where we looked at factors. The one sidebar is that it's limited to $12.5 million. I mean, that's, we can't go over
that's
that, and it's, a,
right,
and it's a one-year, or excuse me, one biennium authorization. So that is one sidebar. We won't go beyond that. And then under other parts of the statute, it does talk about, and I don't know the definition of dislocations is here, which I'm not seeing it in this piece, but it defines dislocated workers in the statute, and we would look to see if they met that determination. That is also a sidebar. So first you have to be, as you can see, may be paid only to eligible dislocated workers. So we have to see if they meet the definition of dislocated, and that is whether they're long-term unemployed, whether or not they have been...
Verlina, where is the $12.5 million sidebar in this bill? I see it being yanked out of the 95 appropriation, the $12 million, but I don't see the $12.5 million specific cap.
The
cap here.
Right. They deleted the $12 million dollar amount in the bill, but the estimate, the fiscal that we looked at, had $12.5 million. As an estimate of the number of people that we could and would pay based on assumptions. And Frank, do you have those assumptions with you?
We did assume an overall 25% increase in the number of people that would be dislocated and meeting the requirements of eligibility of a dislocated worker in the first place because of the projection, economic projections over the next winter. And then from that, we took our current workload, increased it by 25%, and then estimated that of those, about two-thirds would need more than 26 weeks of training in order to complete training programs. And so that estimate is driven by those assumptions of how many dislocated workers there were going to be, and of those, how many would need more than the basic program of 26 weeks of unemployment benefits.
Thank you.
And getting down
there. Representative Packard is recognized.
I just wondered, you have 26 weeks of program. The way the bill's amended, you drop 39 to 26, but then you take out the 52-week cap in Section 3A and 3B. Can you explain why you're doing it that way? I mean, we're talking about 26 weeks, and then we're not talking about 26 weeks. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, that's not our amendment, but I do believe that the amendment was in order to reach an acceptable fiscal impact. The 52-week reference that you see in the bill is simply how far we can extend an individual's unemployment claim for them to receive the benefits that are involved. In other words, a normal claim only has 52 weeks in it to receive 26 weeks worth of unemployment benefits. And if you start getting into extending it another 26 weeks, if you didn't start the training into late enough, you might not be able to get done in time. So this basically just removes a limitation that was more associated with a 39-week program than a 26 one. Am I answering your question?
Why, I just don't understand why it's necessary to cut out the 52-week piece. I mean, you're lowering it from 39 to 26, but you're cutting out the 52-week piece. So it doesn't make any sense to me why you would need to cut out the 52-week piece.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, maybe the sponsors of the bill could speak to that better than we could.
Okay, and then finally, what are the statistics that show that these extended retraining benefits actually work, that they make a lot of sense, that we're putting more workers on the ground as a result of extending the additional 26 weeks?
Mr. Chair and Representative Patridge, the dislocated worker training with supplemental benefits program that we had before was targeted towards timber layoffs, and those were not very successful from a number of people's viewpoint. In that when the doors opened up, they tended to go back to the type of job that they had had. I mean, that's what we found time and time again. These particular individuals don't, as we're hearing it anyway, do not have that opportunity to go back to the same types of jobs because, it's not an industry shutdown. It's across several different industries. What we have worked with our advisory council members, primarily labor, is that and what we learned in the dislocated worker legislation last time was to try it, to tie it to areas given a training plan of interest as well as a job availability for the future. I think you really need to have both of those factors addressed because I know Representative Johnson, for example, saw and have indicated in the past and other people as well that oftentimes people got pushed into training or wanting to take training when in fact they were not the best training opportunity for that individual, and of course they got trained into something that they didn't actually go to work in. So it was mixed on the past types of training. This, I think, is different in that the types of layoffs are different. It's multifaceted. It's not just out of one industry. And we are looking as a system to try to get people into jobs and training that they're actually going to be successful in.
But, Mr. Chair, just a follow-up for the committee, and Ms. Crosley can address that she wants. But I guess that's, if it was not very successful before, and it was more industry-related than anything else, where you're looking at an industry where people have spent their lives in, and this we're not looking at whole industry shutdowns, so they can transfer from one employer to another because it's not an industry-wide shutdown, which you didn't have before. I guess I don't see what sideboards or protections we have to make any assurances that this will be any more successful in the types of training programs, how those training programs will be allocated, or any of those things. It's just an extension of benefits for some training, but there's no sideboards on it based upon our previous history to ensure that we extend these additional benefits that any good will come out of it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Patridge, I really think probably the requesters of the bill need to speak to that. But one thing I need to let you know, the Employment Department administers the funds for the training. And we don't develop the training plan, and I'm not trying to say it's somebody else's problem, but we don't give the training. All of those pieces, I think, need to be coordinated better. And I think that we have made great strides from the time of the early 90s as part of a system to better ensure, I can't say totally ensure, but better ensure that there is a look at the labor market and the potential within that labor market, the types of job needs that an individual needs to have. We find that a lot of people drop out of training because they do not have a base income. We found that time and time again. So this address is kind of that base piece. There still will need to be training dollars. This doesn't pay for the training. So it really does need to be coordinated, and Employment Department is just one player within that. What it does is give the base funding for an individual while in training.
guess what I find is a little bit unusual about this, this is spun off of the timber base here, that people are going back in, it's supposed they were going back into the timber market, or timber business, and I thought we'd done a pretty good job in this state of pretty much decimating that whole line of employment, so I find that somewhat unconvincing. Representative Patrick, just want to follow up?
I just have a thought. I'm concerned about this. 26-week programs, who's going to coordinate those? How are they going to be coordinated? Have you identified the industries and whether a 26-week program even accomplishes what needs to be accomplished? I'm just trying to...
Mr. Chair, Representative Padgett, the coordination is with the community colleges and the Workforce Investment Act partnerships, and that is multifaceted at the local level. So it is a coordination of both the putting together a training plan and also the training. The Employment Department's piece in that, which I can speak to, is whether or not they are unemployed through dislocation. That's a pretty easy thing for us to find out. And then whether or not there's opportunities employment opportunities in those areas that are in the bill, that's something I look at. And then it says that the receipt of those supplemental benefits is conditioned upon demonstrating satisfactory progress and attendance. So the pieces that I'm looking at that I can speak to are those particular areas.
Patrick? But can the Employment Department give me a list of those programs that are 26-week training programs that they think are not going to be hit by the energy crisis and NAFTA that there's going to be jobs in?
I think, go ahead.
Representative. Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, I'd point out it's 26 additional beyond the original 26. So, I'm sorry, six. So overall, the attempt is to try and get beyond the three-month limitation and take it to a six-month limit.
Representative Ringel?
Thank you. I want to back up a little bit and maybe address something that we've been discussing, I guess, from a general standpoint. The thinking is that the four categories set forth here define industries where maybe there will be permanent job loss. So we're not talking about just an economic cycle. We're talking about high energy costs is going to permanently shut down a business, and that's why those employees need to be retrained. Is that fair?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Representative Randall, yes.
I guess the thing that troubles me about these four categories is you could come up with other categories of businesses being, closed out because of economic conditions, and one might be the fishing industry. If the fishery is decimated, those fishermen are going to be looking for their jobs. Maybe other agricultural areas. Could you just respond to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ringo, again, that's probably a question for the requesters of the bill. But to that question, from the Employment Department's perspective, fishing is one of the areas that we are looking at, and we have received and gained approval through the legislature for a grant to deal with the ground fishers. And they are getting a similar type of benefit those areas. And with one additional piece, they don't even have to be eligible for the original unemployment insurance because many of these boat owners and individuals would not have even qualified for unemployment insurance. So there are other avenues that we're trying to look at in helping other dislocations. Agriculture is an area that at this point would not be, as you indicated, unless there was a... The drought aspect to that.
Let me just kind of follow up. Let's say you had a manufacturing facility that was shut down because of overseas competition. Is that going to be covered under the Section 3 there, or is that where it's a secondary effects of foreign trade?
If generally with secondary effects of foreign trade,
primary effect
is NAFTA Trade Act, where we have taken... or there's been some kind of job loss because of trade or they're moving their, the company's people out of state, or those jobs out of state, or...
I guess I'm not talking about the NAFTA context.
Okay.
I'm talking about you've now got a manufacturing facility in China that's producing something. And it, so is that going to be covered?
My belief is yes. I would say, as the department director, that it's broad enough, and I've not heard other instructions from the legislature not to include those.
I guess just a comment, and then I'll let you. I think it's going to be incredibly difficult to find somebody who is not put out of work that's not going to be able to say, well, the foreign trade was some reason why I lost my job, or the energy cost was some reason why I lost my job, and it's very ambiguous, and it almost seems to me that it doesn't make sense to define these like this, that it would be better just as people lose their job and they want to retrain, give them the opportunity. I know that that's going to be a lot more expensive and that throws it out more, but I just think it's going to be difficult to fit within these categories in a way that makes sense.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
With the Chair's indulgence, I would welcome, before we lose what I think are very salient questions, before we lose track of those as the conversation moves on, would it be possible to ask any of the requesters of the bill to help us with this?
They're here on our schedule. We do have, and they will come up. Senator Yee, did you have a question for...
Well, I just want to follow up on what Representative Ringo's concern is. I think that you're saying we need to add other reasons so more unemployed workers can qualify. Because I think with advance in technology, a lot of them probably can use a lot of training in computer use or other advanced technology. So even if they don't qualify under unemployment due to these reasons, I think they should have an opportunity for training. So I would be very supportive in adding E as other reasons for unemployment. Since the economy is slowing, I think it will be very helpful for them to get more training.
Well, just to respond to that, Senator, I don't know whether I would go that far. Maybe it does. It seems to me that these are sort of arbitrary categories. If somebody loses their job because of high energy costs, and let's say that they could verify that, I don't really understand why that person deserves retraining, and somebody else who loses their job because maybe we don't use wagon wheels anymore, why that person doesn't deserve retraining. And I just I don't think it makes sense to categorize it like that.
Mr. Chair, well, I think that there are a lot of unemployed workers due to these ABCD reasons. For example, in my district, metal industries use intensive energies, and they are facing foreign competition. So there are a lot of, whether it's aluminum, tungsten, titanium, zirconium, metal industries who are facing problems in high energy costs, and they are laying off a lot of people. And those workers really need training to get onto another.
Why don't we go ahead at that point and have maybe Mr. Nesbitt come forward as one of the requesters of the bill. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, could I add just one more comment? I want to make sure that, and I apologize if I've confused the individual members, but dislocated workers on any type of dislocation are eligible for retraining, be it technology, be it anything.
It's
the additional 26 weeks,
right.
So I just want to make sure, because
right.
I'm not sure that was clear.
Which the bill doesn't have a sideboards at the 12.5 million.
Right, it doesn't.
It's within the estimate right now, and we need to find out. I understand that these two bills, Senate Bill 397 and House Bill 3759, are kind of inextricably connected, and maybe we can find out what that is, see if there's any objections to the actually putting the sidebar in of the 12.5 million that Representative Johnson had asked about is related to the sidebar. So.
And, Mr. Chair, my final comment then is that connection that you were making. The governor definitely has seen a connection and does see a connection mm-hmm. with this. And that Senate Bill 397 was the department's bill approved by the governor for introduction to lower taxes. And he saw needs out there for workers that are being laid off, that are indicating to him at least and to others that they need a longer period of unemployment insurance benefits to stay in training, and that is also on the table. So these are the kinds of things that has been brought to him as a need. He sees them going together. In other words, if, and I have not heard whether he would or would not be open to a change with the sideboards that you're talking about. But I do know
fiscal,
that
so it's part of the fiscal, so I understand that he's already familiar with the numbers.
Yes,
should
familiar,
be. So if it was in order to accommodate the issues, and that we can do that after we've heard the additional public testimony, but if it will accommodate the bill to push it through for the members, that we address the 52 weeks or that we address the 12 and a half million, then we may want to check with the governor's office to make sure we're okay there.
Thank you.
With that, we'll ask Mr. Nesbitt to come forward. Ken Nesbitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I have written testimony. Some of it I'll cover quickly in order to make time to answer in more detail about the questions I've heard.
Now, let's see. Mr. Nesbitt, I understand that Betsy Earls is here as well from AOI. Did you want to join your testimony together?
Great.
Where you're both coming from the same?
Yes, we are.
Can we do that?
We appreciate that.
And that way we'd have both of you folks here together.
And Mr. Chair, as you noted, we are supporting both House Bill 3959A and Senate Bill 397. The former provides extended unemployment insurance benefits for dislocated workers enrolled in professional technical retraining programs, and the latter reduces payroll taxes paid by employers by smoothing out the rates in the middle of ranges of UI tax rate schedules. And happily, the UI Trust Fund is healthy enough to accomplish both goals. So these two bills combined will save employers $60 million over the next 4 years and provide an estimated $12.5 million in extended benefits to dislocated workers to support their retraining efforts. I want to put this in the context of what we're seeing out there in the workforce currently. I mean, every day when you read the business section of the newspaper, it's like reading the obituaries of family-based jobs. More and more plants are shutting down, not just production, not just temporary production curtailments, but in fact plant closures of the kind we haven't seen since the early 90s in the timber sector. The Office of Community College Services in March, in a study they did, documented 7,265 jobs lost over the previous 7 or 8 months and projected to be lost by July. And then since then, we've had the Employment Department's report showing actually 10,700 fewer jobs in Oregon now than a year ago, and 6,200 fewer manufacturing jobs. And it's manufacturing, that's that sector of the economy, which has the highest proportion of family wage jobs of any sector in the state. But you know, even these figures, which are net of jobs lost versus jobs gained, can mask the true impact on workers and their communities. And we have on the page 2 of my testimony just a sample of the layoffs that we've documented. In fact, there are many more. I could give you 7 or 8 pages of a list like this, which show you the shutdowns and cutbacks experienced to date and the diversity of industries and communities affected. Agri-frozen in Woodburn, which is food processing. Reynolds Metals and Northwest Aluminum, Troutdale and the Dalles, obviously those are aluminum companies. Timber products companies are frequent on the list. York International, an example of a company which shifted its production from Oregon to Mississippi. That's an example of a shift of production to another state or territory of the U.S. Ormet in Albany was related to both energy costs and trade, and I want to talk more to you in a moment about the way in which we're trying to wrap these benefits around existing federal benefits, which I think makes a lot of sense, but also raises questions you've had about why we're specifying the conditions we are. But to the point here, most of these plants are unlikely to reopen anytime soon. You don't, for instance, see us listing here the Freightliner plant, over 1,000 layoffs there. But when economic conditions change, we expect a good number of those workers to be rehired. This list is predominantly those which are in for long-term shutdowns and perhaps permanent shutdowns. And workers in that situation face the daunting prospect of having to step down to lower-paying jobs very often, or retraining for jobs in new occupations that provide family wages and benefits that sustain communities. And that's why House Bill 3759 is so important. But retraining for new jobs takes time, as much as 1 to 2 years, depending on the training program, and money. You need income support to support your family while you're going through that kind of training. And what House Bill 3759 does is provide that income support in the form of extended unemployment benefits to workers who seek and are enrolled in retraining. Now, the architects of our federal trade policies recognize the importance of these kinds of programs. Both NAFTA and Trade Act provide benefits to workers whose layoffs are certified as trade-related. They get up to 2 years of retraining funding, and they get an extra year from the feds of unemployment benefits, so they can take their 26 weeks of state benefits and get another 52 weeks of federal unemployment benefits for a year and a half. But workers who fall outside of that category of layoffs, which are due primarily to the impact of foreign trade, whether it's with China or with Canada or Mexico, Trade Act and NAFTA both have these provisions. Workers who don't fit those categories have only the basic 26 weeks. Can't get beyond that. And in fact, other states recognize that a lot more is needed. In Washington state, dislocated workers can get up to 104 weeks for conditions other than the federally funded trade impact conditions. And in our own state, as you've heard, we used to have provisions, not just for timber workers, but for others in the 90s, from 91 through 97, that provided funding for as much as 39 additional weeks to help workers through retraining. So the bottom line is this, that we believe Oregon, in this environment, can and should do more to assist dislocated workers who are signing up for, committing to, going through retraining, and they all want retraining to jobs that are out there. No one wants to be retrained for jobs that aren't out there. And to answer Representative Patrick's question earlier, I think we have a lot more experience since the early 90s. Now we've gone through the state-level administration of these NAFTA and Trade Act benefits, a lot more activity at the community college level and the Workforce Investment Board level in getting workers through those systems with federal dollars. And also now with more funding under WIA and regional workforce investment boards with representation from businesses in each of the regions of the state, I think there are 12 or 13, are making sure that training programs match up with demand occupations. So I think we've advanced a lot over the last 10 years and have a lot more confidence that the training that's out there is going to be relevant to getting workers into new jobs that continue to support their families. The points then in favor of this bill, obviously there's precedence in Oregon's own unemployment insurance program in the early 90s for such extended benefits. Other states do it. Layoffs are rapidly increasing, and these are in many cases, unfortunately, permanent shutdowns where workers have to seek retraining for new jobs. And finally, as you've heard, there are ample funds in the UI Trust Fund to support these benefits. It's not going to, even with the employer rate reductions, trigger under any projection, come even close to triggering a rate increase for employers by moving them to a higher rate schedule. There's enough margin between the rate schedules under Senate Bill 397 that won't happen. So finally, here's basically the linchpins, if not the sidebars, for House Bill 3759. You have to meet the definition of a dislocated worker, and that definition is in ORS 657.335. You were terminated or laid off, and you're unlikely to return to your previous industry or occupation. You were terminated as a result of any permanent closure or substantial layoff, or you were self-employed and you're now unemployed due to general economic conditions because of natural disasters. And that was language added to that statute, I believe, in 95, so we could cover more agriculture workers. Now, in addition, and here's where I hope to answer some of your questions, House Bill 3759 specifies conditions that would be met before these benefits are payable. If you didn't do that, you would end up putting a lot of state money into programs that are now federally funded, and in fact supplanting the federal dollars. So we have to get creative here. We want to make sure that the dollars are going to supplement what's now already being done at the federal level. And Ms. Crosley and Mr. Ritchie, I think, were explaining it to you in a way that they've explained it to the Department of Labor, and the Department of Labor is okay with this. But we can't be too blunt here. But basically, you have to be a little sophisticated about saying, here's how we want to target these dollars. Because if you just took out those conditions, you would spend a lot of money supplanting federal dollars. That doesn't make sense. So we're trying to find the conditions most prevalent in all these layoffs we're seeing around the state where, in fact, there's dislocation and the need to retrain workers. And we're putting those in with a lot of discretion intended. The department's going to have the discretion to make those decisions, and they're going to have to certify, in addition, that workers are being enrolled in training programs that make sense.
Representative Johnson, clarification.
I want to understand the supplanting federal dollars. I understand just recently there was a press conference talking about the loss of federal dollars. Explain how that factors into this bill.
Well, we are concerned, Representative, about the loss of federal dollars in the future. But right now, there's sufficient dollars to continue approving training under NAFTA and Trade Act certified programs. And there's a hope that with an application being made to the Department of Labor for what's called a National Emergency Grant, that in fact those funds will be sufficient through this federal fiscal year. Next fiscal year, starting October 1, we're looking at cuts of perhaps 13%. We're a little bit worried about that. But if in the event that the feds run out of its allocation for the state and there are some workers who can't get their federal retraining, they could still be certified here. What we're trying to do is design a program that would allow the department to come in after the exhaustion of funds and say, oh, and these criteria could apply secondarily, so that we're not replacing available first dollars from the feds with the state's scarce resources here.
I'm still struggling with the sideboards piece of this, but I want to turn to a question that Representative Ringo asked, and you weren't at the table. I represent a fishing district. The rockfish industry, I think, is being addressed fairly aggressively. Other aspects of that fishery aren't. Where do those workers fit in here?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, we actually asked that question and wondered whether that should be a criterion, but there is separate funding being pursued for those workers, and the fact is that because of a change in the law made, I think, last session or the session before, most fishery workers now are not under covered employment. So unfortunately, they're not paying into the system. Their employers are not paying into the system. There's an exemption there. So very few of them, unlike agricultural workers who are in covered employment, are going to end up being able to have the quarters of payroll coverage. And so they're going to be better served with that separate grant approach.
One more follow-up. Are you not faintly troubled by some of the issues of inequity that have been raised here, that by some, at least the appearance of arbitrary listings of some sectors, those folks would be covered and others would be not? Would not be?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I've woken up a few nights in the middle of the night over the last few months saying, do we get it all? Are these all the conditions? And we think so. We think that probably the majority of the layoffs we're seeing right now will be covered by Federal Trade Act and NAFTA, perhaps two-thirds. It's the other one-third we're trying to get to. And we think these conditions, in all likelihood, will cover those.
Representative Ringo?
What were the reasons for the layoffs, just as an example, in John Day, Grant Western Lumber? 215 jobs.
I believe most of these, and this probably is one instance, I know in QBO's case it was, were certified as NAFTA-related because of the import of cheaper Canadian softwood lumber and the expiration of the Canadian softwood lumber agreement. And so almost most of the forest products layoffs here have been NAFTA-related and NAFTA-certified.
I mean, it's interesting. I was wondering whether this is, you know, related to depletion of resources or environmental regulations, but it's Canadian trade, Canadian competition.
I believe so.
But then my other question is, I don't know how many people live in John Day. I don't think all that many. How are these John Day workers going to be retrained for jobs in John Day? What are they going to do there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ringo, that I think is a question that the local Workforce Investment Board and the local community colleges serving the area are going to have to tackle. I can't,
the real,
from my own knowledge.
The real need, though, is going to be economic development to bring a new employer in. I mean, isn't that right? I mean, you're not going to find 213 jobs that if people were retrained. Oh,
this is where workforce development leads to economic development.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, thank you.
I'm going to ask Representative Patridge's question because it's also mine. Ms. Crosley couldn't answer this, and I hope maybe you can. Who does all this coordinating?
I believe that's the charge and the challenge to the Workforce Investment Board statewide and the community colleges and all the other providers who are represented on that board and coordinating, hopefully, together and with the Employment Department. I don't regularly attend those meetings. I've attended some, in fact, to talk to them about the growing need for their effort to provide retraining to dislocated workers.
Respectfully, I guess the hopefully piece that you just said, when you use the word hopefully, to commit $12 million of the state's money, albeit for a very laudable purpose, it causes me some concern when there seems to be, at different points, disconnects. And there seems to be a lot of like this with everybody else thinking somebody's responsible for the coordinating piece of it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I think the best checkpoint here is the department's control over certifying workers into and saying this is an acceptable program. It's going to lead to reemployment and demand occupation, because unless the department signs off on these retraining programs, the eligibility isn't there.
One follow-up.
You have said in your testimony, if I've understood you correctly, that what you have done is to sweep the net fairly wide, and that your categories here that you've enumerated are for the purpose of trying to include as many people as possible, and yet I don't see anything that caps the fiscal. So if your goal is to include as many dislocated workers as possible, and you've got an estimate of fiscal based on only $12 million, what caps that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, there's no specified cap. It's an estimated fiscal impact based on the department's estimates. And looking at the population of dislocated workers and those who are eligible under federal NAFTA and Trade Act, and those who are not, calculations were made. The whole point here is to target these dollars to where they're needed, to workers who are not getting the federal assistance, and kind of wrap around these benefits so we cover the other workers.
I guess just as a comment, the challenge for some of us is to go home to those segments of workers whose traditional industry is being devastated and say to them, we've taken care of some folks and not everybody. And I heard your testimony about the fisheries, that decisions may have been made that caused them to fall into that situation. But it's going to be a tough sell to be able to convince some they're eligible and some they're not.
Thank you. Senator Connell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been sitting here listening to Representative Engel and Representative Johnson's comments. We can't help but think about when we first started a conversation very similar to this in the 89 session about how many dislocated timber workers there would be because of virtually shutting down the timber industry. I don't know who came up with the word dislocated, but when you are in a community in which you've lived all your life and suddenly your job isn't there because somebody's decided that you can no longer do what you've done, you are named as dislocated. I don't know if that means your joints or what's dislocated, but what happens is, as a matter of fact, you don't have an income anymore nor a job. And you made a very good point, Representative Ringel, about John Day, which is a beautiful little community, savor a guess of somewhere around 500-700 people, but since it's not my district, I hope they'll forgive me for if I'm wrong. But the very thing is that, and John Day and Ochoco Lumber, which is Prineville, Mr. Shelk, that mill has been in the family since 80 years, and those employees are out of work simply from the fact there's no timber available. And they, you know, many of them grew up in Prineville. Where can they go? Maybe they can get over to Ben and get a Burger King, and I don't mean to say Burger King's better than McDonald's, but one of those places, maybe they can get a job. But it's just very unfortunate. Retraining doesn't work. I think it's great to retrain somebody that's been out climbing, logging, tree doing logging to retrain them to work in a computer, but if there isn't a computer job available in their community, how do they move? And how do they go to a community to put down first and last month's payment if there is a job when they don't have any income or unemployment wages to get there? And I support the bill that AOI and AFL-CIO have worked on, but I just wonder about the other workers that we've left behind, that we've retrained, that didn't have a job in the communities they had. Sorry, I came from a very controversial meeting earlier, and I just had to start off. Thank you.
Senator Yee is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm supportive of giving the workers more training and extend the benefits, because I know a lot of workers who are unemployed and who are in the middle of taking training courses, and the extended benefits will help them to continue with the training. But I have a question for Mr. Nisbet. In your testimony, you mentioned that on the first page, the third paragraph, second line, it says, with these two bills, employers will save $16 million over the next 4 years, while dislocated workers will gain an estimated $12.9 million in extended benefits to support the retraining effort. How do you save money and then pay more money?
Mr. Chair and Senator Yee, as you know, there are 8 tax schedules within the UI tax rate system. And what Senate Bill 397 will do, as you saw, will adjust the amounts in the middle ranges. By so doing, it will save employers $60 million. In addition, it will fortuitously, I suppose, it's not a cause and effect here, but it also, when you look at the post-397 scenario and how the rates line up, it will have created more funding margins between the schedules, so that an amount like $12.5 million comes nowhere near tipping employers into the next higher rate schedule. So these extra margins between the schedules that happen to result from the implementation of Senate Bill 397 leave plenty of room for modest benefit improvements without affecting employer rates.
So is this done by diversion, like we funded JobSup?
Well, this is called the trust fund, isn't it?
Yes. Chair Butler, an extension of the regular unemployment insurance benefits. Directly from the benefit trust fund.
Oh, based on the extra in margin.
That's right.
When they move into a reduced level.
That's correct. Mr. Chair and Senator Yee, it's not a diversion because this is within the primary scope of the UI program, so you don't need to do a diversion. And then secondarily, the way the funding margins line up after implementation of 397, there's no impact on employer rate brackets.
We have just a few minutes before we're to meet back into other meetings, but I wanted to just check, Ms. Earls, did you have lots of additional testimony that you wanted to give us?
No.
While we have you both at the table, I would like to ask this question. If, and I looking back at the unengrossed 3759, I noticed that there was a spot there for a dollar amount to be inserted. I noticed that the A engrossments dropped that spot out and just block out that whole section relative to the and then insert the through June 30, 2003. To accommodate some of the concerns that have been expressed, if we were to go back and insert the $12.5 million, which is the current estimated fiscal, would that give sufficient angst to anyone that we're going to do some damage to this particular bill, or the combination of them both going to the governor's office?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls from Associated Oregon Industries, and since we are in hearing on both these bills, let me just get on the record that AOI supports Senate Bill 397 and 3759. We have appreciated the opportunity to work with AFL on both bills. As to your question, we had talked about capping the amount at one time when it became apparent that there would be plenty of money in the gap of the UI Trust Fund between how much we needed for benefits and how much it would take to kick us up into the next tax schedule. We agreed with AFL to just go ahead with the program at 26 additional weeks without a cap, based on what we think are fairly reasonable estimates by the Employment Department of how much money it would take up. I don't know if, given the worsening economic situation, you necessarily want to put a cap on those, on the amount that will go for those benefits. If it would make you all feel comfortable, I think that's fine, but we might be in an economic situation where you would like to put a little bit of faith in the Employment Department's estimates and just go with what we have.
I guess the concern that Representative Patridge expressed as he was being called into a different meeting at 11 o'clock was that the worsening situation that we are talking about may actually thrust us to the full top end of the $12.5 million, and without additional compensation set aside in the actual UI Trust Fund for this particular extension, given the other sidebars that there are the Community College and Workforce Investment Act committees in place and so forth, and that we are dropping it to the 26 weeks dropping the 52 week period. His concern was what happens if the situation does continue and you start moving to the edge of that, could it do some serious damage? I assume that the $12.5 million is the upper limit of the estimated serious damage that we may be looking at.
It's, Mr. Chair, I believe 12.54 is, and that number was arrived at after we agreed to not try and go forward with the 39 weeks that used to be in the law, but reduce it to 26, and also apply the conditions you see. So we'll hopefully, in fact, restraining costs that way, but directing the dollars to the workers who need them. I would be concerned if, in fact, a worst-case scenario develops and there are more workers taking advantage of this program than estimated, that you end up just saying no to those workers by, let's say, January of 2003 or something, and they're suddenly frozen out, as opposed to a modest...
Since there would be a rebalance at that point anyway, and the session would be recalled.
And I would point out further, you have a large margin in your UI trust fund in these brackets I was describing. $100 million was the margin, and this is a $12.5 million.
Senator Cornell has been in a rebalance before. I guess at that point, most anything is on the table, so if you have to come back and replenish it at that point, we could do that. But I want to respect where you're coming from, too. Senator Ringo, or Representative Ringo.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify something. Is this figure, the $12.5 million, is that the estimated figure, or is that the estimated top end?
I believe Mr. Ritchie can best answer that, but I know he built the number from the bottom up, so
I'll let him. Could you answer that, Mr. Ritchie? Because, Mr. Chair, I think if that figure is the estimated figure, then maybe whatever sideboard that you might want to build in would be a good bit higher.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ringel, I apologize. I was consulting with my director. That's right, okay. It's time you asked the question. So
you know,
I heard.
I usually get caught not quite listening. I'm glad to catch a witness.
The question, if I understood the question, it is: was the estimate sort of a middle of the road estimate or a worst case scenario type estimate?
Yes, exactly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ringel, again for the record, my name is Frank Ritchie. I'm with the Employment Department. I would have to characterize it as a more middle-of-the-road type, not a worst upper limit. We were not asked to do a sort of worst-case scenario and didn't.
I see.
But would you also agree, then, with the comment Mr. Nez was relative to the fact that there would be, in that circumstance, you would also have sufficient other collections in the level of employment collections, unemployment collections at that point, that may be accomplished or accommodated in the trust fund?
If the numbers went above $12.54 million without the trust fund would still be able to accommodate another several million dollars without making any difference to employer tax schedules because of, as Mr. Nesbitt mentioned, the Senate Bill 397 changes do build in margins of benefit payouts that could be made here without impacting employer tax schedules. So several more million dollars could be paid out without any impact on employers. So if there was no limitation in the bill, that adjustment
would be made out of the trust fund without any problem.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Ritchie. We do have three other folks signed up, Sharon Hull, Janice Abram, and Rufus Galloway. If you folks would like to come up, if you're still in the room, we'd just remind you that we are now officially out of time, having heard from the sponsors and the department, so we'll take your testimony as fast as we possibly can in public hearing. Mr. Galloway.
Okay. My name is Janice Abraham. I'm a dislocated worker. They closed my plant. I have no job. I need training. What I did, I can't do again.
Excuse me, where do you live?
In Woodward, Oregon. And I'm not real good with products. Sorry. I'm a cannery worker. I worked in quality control for 18 years. I was a supervisor of quality control for 6 years. I worked at the plant 20 years. Because of the antiquated practices and equipment, my job can't go anywhere. I can't earn $30,000 like I did before. I have a family. I have 6 children. We really need this. We need these extra weeks. We need to support our families. Some people need to get their GEDs. We have about a large percentage of people that don't have their GEDs that work at the cannery. They need their GEDs. Once they get their GEDs, then they can go into training to support their families. The training I'm looking at is 16 months, and it's state approved. Yes, I do have NAFTA, but I've been off work since the end of April. I haven't started school yet. I still have hoops to jump through. I don't want my unemployment to run out. I don't want to lose my house. I want to keep what I have. And I want my children to be able to live. I want to be able to pay my bills. Just on unemployment, I'm losing $12,000 a year. That's if I didn't get me overtime. We really need this. We need this. We need this. There's not work in Woodburn. There's just not. And if I went to another cannery, I'd start out at minimum wage. That's not. I can't pay my health payment. We need this for training. I need this to get on my feet. I need it. The job I'm looking at will make start at $25,000 a year, which will work. And that's what I want to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Aaron. Representative Ringo is recognized.
I know we're kind of late. Your job loss was due to NAFTA?
Yes.
Job moved south of the border.
Yes, they decided that we were economically unfeasible to keep us open, and they moved our orders to Watsonville and elsewhere, and all the production of broccoli and cauliflower is from Mexico, and strawberries, stuff we did.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much. Yes, certainly. Senator Yee?
Thank you. What kind of retraining are you looking at that would make $25,000?
I'm going into the paralegal program.
Planning to be a paralegal?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Next, Ms. Hall or Mr. Yell?
Hi, my name is Sharon Hall, Mr. Chair, Chair Members, and I'm a dislocated worker. I work for Northwest Aluminum. And this extension on unemployment would be really beneficial to me because I am going to start school. And whether or not I get an extension depends on whether I finish. And if I finish and get my license, I've got a guaranteed job. And I'd really like your help to do that. Thank you.
Representative Johnson?
Would you mind answering the same questions that Representative Ringo posed? What did you do and what are you retraining to do?
I was a cell operator at Northwest Aluminum, and I plan on going to duty school.
Going to duty school.
It takes me 2 weeks to get in to see an eye beautician, and I figure people need to have haircuts.
Thank you very much. Mr. Galloway.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am a displaced worker from York International in Milwaukee. I've worked there for 23 years. and I'm among a majority of the people that work there, have worked there over 20. We're all completely out of work because they decided to move the plant to Mississippi. I also have a health condition, so I need to be retrained for a lighter duty job. I already have started some training in computer keyboarding, and when my training will start is about the time my unemployment will run out. When my unemployment runs out, I've got to look for work because I can't go to school with no money. I've got to pay my bills. I've already let my car go back and a few other things. All of us that work there work kind of in a captive field. It's HVAC. We build air conditioning, heating, ventilating systems, and there's only a couple other plants in the Northwest to do that, and they're not going to be able to absorb the 200-plus employees that were working at York International when this happened. And I don't see any way around not going back to school for most of us to find a job that we can do to support our families. And
let me just ask this question in that regard, if I could, please, Mr. Galloway, and that
sir.
Is this. You say that your unemployment benefits run out about the time that you start back into school?
Right.
That's currently 26 weeks right now.
I will be out of unemployment about September. And September is about when Clackamas Community starts their program.
I see. So you couldn't have taken a summer class to start in?
Right now, I'm taking a summer class on my own. I've kind of got to watch what I do with my money. And I'm trying to do as much as I can for as little as I can get by with. So, you know, if I sign up for those classes, my unemployment will run out about the time I'm supposed to start them because I started into this too late to sign up for summer classes. And when that period of time comes that I can get into those classes and my unemployment is gone, I'm going to have to go out and look for work.
I'm having a little bit of trouble with the timing. Right now you've got 26 weeks.
Right, and that started March 30th.
March 30th, and it was too late to register for summer classes?
Well, at that time I went through, I don't know if you're familiar with ETBS or not, in Merrillhurst College. It's in Employee Training and Business Systems. And I was going through their classes just because I didn't know where to go. You know, I've been in one place for 23 years. In fact, in the last 40 years, I've only claimed unemployment for like a total of about 4 weeks. So I'm lost. I don't know where to go, what to look for, or anything else. So I went there, and they started putting me through different programs to show me where to go. Well, now that I'm done with those, I know where to go, but now half of my unemployment's gone.
What will change by the extension of this, other than just the receipt of the employment unemployment benefits? Will you expect more money as a result of this, or just the continuation of the employment benefits?
I just need the continuation of my employment benefits because I can make the rest of it. I can put the package together with the help of ETBS.
I see. Okay.
I have some backing.
Okay.
But this isn't just for me. There's 11,000 plus people in that position.
And that's there's 200 plus in your situation over in Milwaukee from the York alone, and then there's another couple of thousand on the page there. So I appreciate that. Other questions for the three witnesses? Thank you very much. We appreciate
you
folks coming in. With that, I think we're officially out of time. I'm probably subject to call very shortly. I wanted to get the feel of the members. We've heard testimony about the 12-5 being current limit or the estimated amount. Would this committee, if we move to work session, feel okay about moving both of these bills as is? I think we could do that then when we get to the
Mr. Chair. Is there, and I would pose this to Mr. Nesbitt or Verlina, is there a mechanism by which the legislature could get some kind of a report about the whether the estimate approximates the number of workers that are actually making the claims?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, one thing that comes to mind, this committee has put in a report that we'll be making to the legislature for claimant reemployment, and we could add that and augment, and you would have my promise to do that as part of that report, because these are claimants. They will be in training, but we could make that a component part of that report if you would desire.
You have her word on it.
And I happily and readily accept it.
You know her telephone number.
I do.
All right.
Mr. Chair, is that acceptable, Mr. Nesbitt, to you?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. We will open a work session, and we'll open a work session first on Senate Bill 397. Representative Johnson now moves Senate Bill 397 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? None noted? So ordered. We'll now open a work session on House Bill 3759 as they engross. Representative Johnson now moves.
We didn't get into great detail on the fiscal impact, Chair Butler and members of the committee, but I wanted you to know that the department did put in some workload impact in relationship to handling this kind of worker. At this point, it is not LFO's recommendation to add any limitation, I think, to the department's budget, but to be aware that if, in the event that these dislocated workers are numerous, they may need to come back to the emergency board to get a limited duration
position.
And that's
for the $12.54 million
to assist for the
benefits directly, mm-hmm. and not with regard to the full-time or the part-time positions, limited positions.
I just want to understand, Mr. Chair, you said that they would come back for a limited position. They requested three positions, 2.5 FTE and 300.
Yes. We just went with fiscal on it at $12.54 million.
Okay.
Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, and they did note that in their fiscal impact, but that wasn't necessarily a formal request, nor was it anything that they are indicating that there's a workload associated with providing the extended benefit.
Right. And you're just saying there may be an opportunity for them to come back. I'm not contemplating that in the motion that Chair Butler is anticipating I'm going to make.
No, I just want that on the record for the discussion so that if they do have to come back, that was something that we had
okay.
discussed so that it wasn't...
Haven't been discussed for things on the moves. Representative Johnson now moves legislative fiscal office recommendation as relative to House Bill 3759. Goes to the full committee with due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Any objection with regard to House Bill 3759 as presently engrossed? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. And we will ask representatives, let's see, Representative Johnson, you're on the full. Representative Ringer, would you like to hear those asked? Okay, as they come back, and Senator Yee to the Senate, and do you want to split them up between the full committee? Senate Bill 379 to the full 397 to the full committee, House Bill 3759 to the full.
The only, Mr. Chair, if you would indulge me, they seem to come together as a rather attractive package, and we heard testimony that said part of their...
Mm-hmm.
They were crafted simultaneously. It might be well to keep them together as a...
In the full. Okay. And, all right, we'll do that in the full. Senator Yee will carry them both to full then. All right, with that, we will go ahead. Then anything further than for today's meeting?
That's it for them.
All right. And we do have...
full and for the Senate.
Yes. We do have, we will close them the work sessions on both of Senate Bill 397 and House Bill 3759 as they engross. We have further on our agenda today House Bill 3530. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I spoke to Mr. McCulley, and he is out having amendments, my amendments, drafted to that bill. I told him that you and I had spoken, and he seemed quite amenable to that.
Okay. These are the Representative Johnson's
accountability measures.
Okay.
On the county fair funding.
Okay. You're not done yet?
Are you familiar with those?
No, I'm not familiar.
Okay.
If you wouldn't mind having
getting me a copy of the...
Of the amendment.
Sure, they're being drafted right now. The bill, I brought copies of the bill for everybody.
39.
The amendments are happening right this second.
Okay.
So I didn't get a chance.
It's postponed, and you did your amendment.
Yeah.
Well, we carried over the problem because your amendments...
If they throw out terms, you come back.
So what we will do is we will open the public hearing. We'll open the public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 3530, and we will postpone and carry over the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3530 until even time tomorrow. With that, we will go ahead and close that session. Thank you.
Good.